no recording. It was mic and mic, but no record. Yeah, I forgot to hit the record button. Doesn't do it automatically, unfortunately. Okay. Alright, so we are done with memory management. Okay, so we have actually done two major components of the course. First one was processes, threads and scheduling. And the second one was memory management, virtual memory and so on. Okay, so now, so just a quick recap of what we did last time, where to talk about effectively approximations to LRU. We said LRU is a good algorithm, but it's expensive to implement in practice. So we looked at second chance and enhanced second chance. And the second thing we talked about was how to decide how much memory to allocate to a process. Okay, and the basic idea is to ensure that each process gets at least its working set size, okay, to ensure that it doesn't page a lot. Okay, and we looked at how one could go about doing that. So what we will do today is to talk about a new topic, which is file systems. Okay, so this is going to be the third big component of the course. The last one is going to be distributed systems and networking. Okay, so this is basically a new topic, as I mentioned. And so these are the this is a picture that I had put up very early on, okay, in the first lecture or so. And we said, what are key abstractions that the operating system provides to users? What are the underlying resources? So if you look at a typical machine, the key resources on that machine are the CPU, the processor, memory, and the storage device, which is typically the disk. Okay? There's also, as far as CPU is concerned, the abstraction that the OS provides are processes and threads. Okay, that we already studied. Okay? So this is how the OS manages that resource. How does the OS manage memory? You have the concept of an address space of a process, and the memory manager in the OS allocates memory via pages to this address space. Okay, so that's what we have been talking about. So this is the last major abstraction, okay, which is that hardware device is the disk, and what is the OS exporting to users is what we are going to talk about today, which is the notion of files and the file system. Okay. There is one more thing here that is coming down, which is the network card, and what is the abstraction that's provided to you, which is that of a distributed system. But that is considered to be more of a later add-on to operating system. This is what classical operating systems manage, okay, on the machine. So that's where we are. Okay, so here is a picture that shows the file system abstraction, if you will. Okay, so there are multiple layers. At the very bottom, you have hardware devices. Okay, so this could be a hard disk on your machine, it could be a CD-ROM drive, it could be a USB thumb drive, doesn't matter, any storage device. Okay, it could even be tape drives for that matter. Okay, so that's at the very bottom. This is a physical device. So one layer above this is the device driver interface. Okay, this is how device drivers do low level I/O to these devices. Okay, I/O is input output. So in case of a disk, you have a disk driver. Okay? If you had a CD-ROM or a DVD-ROM drive, and you would need a DVD-ROM driver, which would do something similar. Okay? So what is that device driver doing? It's doing low-level I/O. It can move the disk. It can move the disk to a particular location. It can read and write data from that location. Okay? That's basically what it is doing. Yeah, this is not what we are going to talk about today. Yeah, this is the low-level interface. Built on top of this low-level interface is basically is what is called the file system. Okay, this, what this does is it takes this low-level device and it abstracts, rather provides the abstraction of files and a file system. So it allows users to construct this notion of files. It allows you to store these files. It allows you to organize them in directories and so on. Okay? And this is device independent. Okay, this sits above the device driver. So that's a sample of the APIs or the system calls that the file system supports in order to allow applications or users to read or write. So we'll talk about opening and closing files, reading and writing files, creating directories and whatnot in today's class. Okay. So this is a system called API that the file system. So this is the file system layer. This is the device driver layer. This is the physical device. So this is what you export to applications, okay, or users. Now, typically applications or users don't use this system called API to manipulate files. Okay. Rather, what is done is there are libraries that are written at the user level. Okay. You actually use the API provided to you by the library. Okay. So, for example, you use printf and scanf, or in Java you can use the read lines and whatnot. So, those libraries in turn use the system called API to interact with the device. Okay. So, when you write application, you could of course directly use system calls to do IO, but that's a level of interface that's a little too low for you. So you have application like the Java VM is written on top of the system called API, and it provides even higher level abstraction to application. Okay. So, when you write application, there's a library interface that's sitting in between that has another interface that you export. That's what you use. Now, when you have applications like the shell, okay, this is a command line interface, and you can have the shell commands that themselves use these API to allow you to manipulate files. Okay. So, that's the picture to keep in mind. Okay, any questions about what this is? So, what we are going to do today is actually look at this layer. Okay, this we will come back to later. So, this is what we are going to look at. Okay. So, before we even talk about file systems, let's take a user's perspective on their data. Okay. So, what do you expect when you try to store data on your machine, on the hard drive? Yeah, or for that matter on your USB drive or anything else. Okay. So, these are the characteristics you are expecting from the system. Okay. This is what the operating system also provides to you. So, persistence. Okay. You want any data that you store on your hard disk to persist. Okay, what that means is if you reboot your machine, you don't want that data to disappear. Okay, it should persist on the device across power cycles, across crashes of your operating system or crashes of applications and so on. So, this is something that's important. Okay, anything you store in RAM is volatile, meaning if you reboot the machine, any contents of the RAM go away. But anything you store on disk is not volatile, it is persistent. Okay, so, it stays across reboots. That's one thing. Second thing is speed. You expect to get to your data quickly. Okay? Now, speed is a relative term, but you are expecting to be able to interactively access files and do manipulate your files. Okay? Size. You want to be able to store lots of data. Okay? You can assume that typical users not only have files for programs and applications, but you have larger files for audio, video, images, all of this multimedia content. Okay? So, these data sizes can be large and you want to be able to store a lot of data on your disk. Okay? Sharing and protection. So, you need abilities to share files across users, share files on a network and so on. Okay? And also protecting your private data. So, there are some things you don't want to share and some things you do want to share. So, how should the operating system enable this level of sharing and protection? Okay. Finally, you want ease of use. You want to be able to easily find your files, examine them, modify them and so on. Okay. All right. So, how does the hardware and the operating system provide these features? Okay. So, the first three characteristics I mentioned are actually satisfied by the hardware device itself, and the others are built by the operating system on top of the device. Okay, persistence, the nature of disks is such that it's non-volatile memory, so any data you stick on a disk doesn't go away. Okay, so the hardware is giving this for us, giving this to us rather. So speed, this is gained through random access. Okay, unlike things like tape drives that are sequentially accessed. Okay, disks are a random access device. You can store anything anywhere and get to it quickly. Okay, so this allows you speedy access. Okay, size, and disks keep getting bigger. Okay, typically, if you buy a PC today, you will have hundreds of gigabytes. Okay, so it's you can already buy one terabyte disk drive on the market today. Okay, and this just keeps growing. So that's not a problem. You can get plenty of storage space by just buying newer or bigger disks or adding more disks to your machine. Okay. So all of that is given to us by the hardware. So what does the operating system provide to us? Okay. So operating system also adds to the persistence on the disk. Okay. It uses some notion of redundancy to recover from failures. Okay. Typically, if you look at modern file systems, they keep track of what are the operations that have been performed on the file system so that if there is a sudden disk crash, okay, you yank the power or your battery on your laptop drives and your machine is not shut down. When it wakes up, it can do some additional check and make sure all of the data is not only persistent but consistent. Okay? So, although the disk is providing non-volatile memory, it doesn't mean that data that you store on it is, cannot be corrupted. So, to prevent data corruption, the operating system or the file system can add some features, okay, and make it even better. Sharing and protection, you know that every files you have access control available on the files through the use of permission bits in Unix, for example. So there are read, write and execute privileges that you can specify on a user group and world basis in the context of Unix, and other operating systems do something similar. Okay, ease of use, this comes through variety of ways. Okay, the most important one is the ability to organize your files into folders or directories and have a hierarchical structure. Okay? So you can organize the files on disk, and this allows you to easily access those files. Okay? Modern operating systems also provide you a search feature, which makes it even better. Okay? You don't even need to remember what directory did you store something on. Okay? You can just use a search feature on most on modern operating system that has indexed all of the data on your disk drive, and then you can search. It's like Google interface, and then you can just get to your file. Okay, so in the context of Macs, you have Spotlight, Windows has desktop search, and then Google also provides similar features. So that adds to the ease of use of files that you've stored. Okay? And then what the file system is itself doing is it's allowing you to name your files. Okay? So your files are not numbers, but they are human readable names that you provide. Okay, so that way you know that spider.cc or whatever you wrote for your project, you know the name of the files and you know what is contained in that file. Okay, this is a name you provide. Okay, the ability to name data objects also adds to the ease of use. And last but not least, the operating system is transparently taking care of where do you store these files on disks and how to manage the disk. You don't really have to worry about, I want to store the file on this location on disk. It is going to manage the disk automatically, just as it manages memory automatically for you by allocating memory to processes. Okay. Any questions on this? This is fairly straightforward stuff. And now we'll start talking about the concept of a file, the operations you can perform on a file, and so on. Okay. So what is shown there is basically the definition of a file. Okay, you know what a file is, but we will define this to be the logical unit of storage on a storage device. This is the granularity of storage. Okay? So formally a file is a named collection of related information. Okay? So what does that mean? Okay, any file has a name. Okay? That's why it's a named object. Okay? And file contains some related information. Okay? File has some number of bytes in it. Okay? And this is information as far as the user is concerned. So this is a source file. A file that you write in C++. The information in a file is the program or a part of a program that you write. Okay? So that's what we mean by related information, and that is recorded on secondary storage. Okay? Meaning the files or these objects live on secondary storage, which means they are persistent. Okay? They don't go away until you delete them explicitly. Okay? So that's what it means. Okay? Named collection of related information. Now it's a mundane definition, but it's what we will use. Okay. So files can contain, as far as we are concerned, okay, programs or data. Okay. Programs could be source or binary, and data could be anything. It could be Excel spreadsheet, or it could be just some other things that you have stored in this file. Okay. Files could have a structure, okay, and some file systems don't impose any structure on them. Okay. What does this mean? Okay. So if you look at Unix, okay, Unix implements files as a sequential or as a sequence of bytes. Okay? A Unix file system does not interpret what is inside the file. Okay? It doesn't know and it doesn't care. Okay? It just assumes that file contains data and data is bits, okay, or bytes. And then you just get to your data. It's left to the application to interpret what is in the file. Okay? So in this case, you cannot even have types associated with files because you don't impose any structure on the file. Okay, now contrast this to what some mainframe file systems do. Okay. In mainframe file systems, files are basically sequence of structured records. So if you define a file, you have to define the structure of a file, saying a file consists of records. Each record may have some fields. Okay, so if this is a database file, for example, you could have the name, let's say the student database. Okay, so or course roster, let's call it the course roster. So you will have to define this file, saying this file has record, each record has this field with the name of a student, the student ID. Okay, and then maybe email address and some other information. Okay. So this is already defining a structure on the file, so you know exactly what is contained in the file and what the structure of the file is. Compare this with Unix. Unix, you can store the same information, but as far as the file system is concerned, it doesn't know what is inside the file. Okay. When you have structured file, the file system actually knows what is contained inside the file. That's the difference between the two. Any questions on this? Yes.
What's the benefit? Why would people use Unix implementation?
Okay, that's a good question. So this is Unix and this is mainframe. So why? What's the benefit of imposing a structure versus not having a structure? Right. So if you don't have a structure, that simplifies the design of the file system. Okay. So file system doesn't have to know about what's in the file. It puts the complexity into the application. Okay, so let's take a concrete example. If you have a structured file system, you could go and say, give me the 10th record. Okay, the file system would know, because it knows the structure of a file, what the size of a record is. It knows where each record begins in the file. So it could just go to the 10th such record, just retrieve this part and give it to you. Okay, in a Unix file system, the application has to do all that. The application has to know what is stored in this file. Okay, let's say it's the same data. Okay, so if you want to get the 10th record, the application will have to do a calculation saying each record is, let's say, r bytes in size. So the 10th record will be at this byte offset. Okay, then it will have to seek to that byte offset and say read whatever this s bytes is and then get it. So this is all done by the application. Okay, so it's all where do you want to put the complexity? Do you want to make the file system smarter and application simpler, or do you not want to keep the file system simpler and put the complexity on the application? That's the trade-off, okay, typically between these things. Okay. Yes.
Does storing the files in the record does that take significantly more memory to store the file that way?
It doesn't need more memory. You just have to have more metadata for a file. So when you have, we will talk about the structure of a file system. You have data and you have metadata. Metadata is information about the file itself. Typically, this is things like the username, size of a file, time of creation, and all of this. So here, you would have to store the structure as well. And this is information that the file system maintains. Okay? So you are using a little more disk space because you have to keep this information in the file system. In that sense, it has more overhead. It's not more memory, it's more disk space.
Yeah, that's what I
meant. Yes. So, you do need to keep that extra information in the file system. So, that's why it is a more complex file system. Okay. So, the similar thing applies to file attributes. Okay? There are file systems that allow you to not only have structure, but also types of files. And there are other file systems that don't interpret what's in the file. So type of a file is, so let's say if the file system knows that this is a Word document, okay, .doc and your .ppt and let's say .java, .cc and so on. So if you have these file types and the file system actually knows what the type of the file is, then it can do some things for you. Okay? And there are other file systems where the file system doesn't try to interpret types. All files are a sequence of bytes. Okay? The file system does not know what type of a file. It cannot distinguish between a Word document and source code, okay, like a Java file. Okay? So, as you know, Windows and Macs allow you to have file types. Okay? So, when you double click on, let's say, your Java file, it opens up in your favorite editor that you associated with that file type. Okay? It opens a program that knows about this file type. Other operating systems will not do that. Unix operating systems do not have this notion of a file type, so you cannot tell it to open a file. It doesn't know what application to use. Okay. Now this can be again handled at the application layer. Okay. So if you in Linux, for example, you use an X-Windows GUI, so you could use KDE or GNOME or so on. So those actually keep this type information outside the file system. Okay. So when you double click on a file in Linux, it's not the file system that tells you what application to open. You have this mapping stored somewhere else, and that GUI application actually has this knowledge, and it fires up some program to open this file for you. Yes, question.
How do magic numbers work into this?
How do magic numbers work into this? Magic numbers are a way of storing file types. Okay, but that is sometimes not interpreted by the file system. That's actually information you keep in the file to allow applications to figure out what type of a file it is. Okay? Any questions here? Is this clear? So there are other file attributes that most file systems support, which is the protection, the creation time, the user, the size of a file, and so on. Okay. So now with that background, we are going to start talking about file operations, and what our goal here is to actually understand what the operating system does for each of these file operations. So here are operations that we'll talk about. So these don't include directory operations now. We'll come back to that later in the class. Okay, so these are operations in the file itself. You can create a file, delete a file, open a file, read to it, write to it, seek to a certain location in the file, close the file. Okay. These are naming operations. You can set attributes. You can change the permission bits. You can look up the permission bits or other attributes as to what is the size of the file and so on. You can create hard and soft links. We'll come back to this. You can change the name of a file. Okay? Now, these are supposed to be implemented as system calls in a particular operating system, but these are abstract names of system calls. For example, these would have different names in Windows and Unix, okay? But the concept is what we'll talk about here rather than the specific details of what is the name of the system call in Unix or Linux or Mac and so on. Okay, so let's take one at a time, then take these one at a time and understand. Okay. Okay. Before that, I need to present some data structures that these system calls will use. Okay, so now as far as the kernel is concerned, operating system kernel is concerned, it keeps two data structures, okay, to implement all of these system calls. So we are not yet talking about the underlying file system, we are just talking about this API. Okay, so in this picture, we are just trying to understand how these calls are implemented. Then we will look at how the file system actually maintains data on disk next. Okay. So, what are the data structures that the operating system need to maintain? So, there are two tables. There's an open file table. This is the global list of all files that are currently open for input and output, for either reading or writing. And this is a per process file table, which says for this particular process what files it is reading or writing. Okay. So, these are two data structures you have to keep track of. So, what's in the open file table? You have open count, saying how many processes are currently accessing the files. You keep track of attributes, the owner of the file, the protection information, and so on. Okay, there is location of the file on disk, okay, and pointers to where this file is in memory if it's cached. And for each process, okay, and this table is actually stored in the process control block. The process control block not only has memory management information and all of the rest that we have talked about, it also has a per process file table saying what are the files that are open. Okay, pointer to the entry in the file, current position, the mode in which the file is being accessed, and pointers to the file buffer. Okay, we'll look at why you need all of this information. Okay, so let's start with the process of creating a file. Okay, so you basically want to create a new file on your file system. What does the operating system need to do to enable this? Conceptually, if you want to create a file, what would you have to do as an operating system? So those are the details. I'm asking conceptually what you have to do. Of course, you have to do all of that. Suppose you want to go into a directory and you try to create a new file. Right? So, what do you do? What do you have to do there?
So first, I think you'd have to allocate disk space, which you probably have to check to see if it's available. And then you have to associate it with a directory.
Okay, that's fair. So first thing you have to do is make sure that you are allowed to do this operation, right? So you try to create a file or a folder, or doesn't matter what it is. Okay, you need to check permission, saying, does this user have capability to do this, authority to do this? Okay, if you try to create a file in some directory, you don't have permissions, then it has to deny that operation. Okay? So first thing you do is to check permissions. Okay, so assume that the user has the privilege to create a file. Okay, what's the next thing you do? You make sure that you have sufficient space. Okay, you have sufficient disk space to create this file. Okay, if you are out of space, you would reject. Okay, so if you are 100% full, your disk is completely full, you don't allow users to create any file, you return an error. Okay, so these are initial checks, permission checks, there are space checks and so on. Okay, that's the first thing. Once you have done this, okay, then you actually create this file. Okay, what does that mean? So you have to create a new file descriptor for this file. The file descriptor contains the name of the file, is the location on disk that the file is stored, and all of the file attributes. Okay, who are you? Meaning, who is the user of who created this file? What time was it created? Okay, all of this. Okay, and then you basically add this file descriptor to the directory that contains the file. Let's say a new file has been created by this user, you have to store this in the directory. A directory is merely a table that has a list of all the files contained in it. Okay, so this is all the steps that the operating system has to do. So let's just look at an example here. Okay, I presume you know how to create a file, but I'm just trying to show you some stuff here. Okay, so let's look at this. Okay, so here is, so let's create something. Okay, so I'm going to create a folder, not a file here, but that's okay. So I created this thing called foo. Okay, so okay, let's do this. Okay, so internally the file system has actually created a new object, and it has all of this information in it. Okay, so what is the kind of a file? Okay, what's the size of the file, which is 0 bytes? Okay, where is it? That's the directory. Okay, what time was it created? What time was it modified? Then it says what time was it opened, and here are all the permission bits that have been associated with it. Okay, it seems like this is easier to just do here. So there is foo, so it says a directory, it has read, write, execute for the user. So all of this the file system has to do. Okay, internally. Okay, so it has created an object, it has actually written this into the directory, and it has stored all of this information in it. Right now we haven't done anything with it, we just created a blank file. In this case, it's a blank directory. Okay. Is this clear? Any questions here? So here is a directory listing. Okay, so this is what is stored in the directory. Okay, you will see that it basically has a list of all the files in there. Okay, it also has a pointer to its inode, which this thing is not showing. We will come back to inodes later. Okay. So next, deleting a file. Okay, this is very simple. Okay, you have a file, you're just trying to delete it. You have to first find the directory that contains the file. Okay, again you have to check permissions to make sure you have the permissions to delete a file. Okay, if you don't, then you have to deny the request. Once that is done, then you free the blocks of the file, basically delete all the data, meaning all of the disk blocks are returned to the free list, and you remove the descriptor from the directory. Okay. Yes.
Does it actually delete the disk blocks, or does it just take it out of the file?
Right. That's a good, so there are a couple of questions. One is, do the blocks actually get overwritten? And then there is this question that I put here. So typically you just return the blocks to the free list. You don't zero the blocks out. So the data is still on your disk, meaning that if you wrote something to a file, it's actually stored there. Okay, it's not removed. Okay, but those blocks are just returned to the free list so that they can be overwritten. Okay, so what that means is if you actually have low level access to the disk, all of your, if you may think you deleted a file, but the data is still resident, so you can actually go and read this data. This is how some tools can do file restore, or this is how you can actually go read what was actually stored on your file system before you deleted it. So deletion doesn't mean the data is gone. Only the file is removed from the directory and the blocks are returned to a list to be overwritten at a later time. Okay. Now some operating systems allow you to do what is called secure delete. Okay. What does a secure delete do? Before it does any of this, it actually goes and writes zeros multiple times to the data. Okay. Then it removes the blocks. Okay. So whatever is in the file is first overwritten by garbage. Sometimes you do it multiple times just to make sure you cannot retrieve it. And then you free the blocks. So when the blocks are returned to the free list, the data is not there, but some garbage is overwritten on it. Okay, so if you actually do secure remove SRM on Macs or similar stuff on Unix, that is what it does. Okay, it basically, before it deletes, it goes and overwrites the content so nobody can recover it. Okay, in this case, the data is basically gone. You cannot retrieve it. Okay. So that's one thing. The other thing is this question that I put here, which is, I haven't talked about hardlings, but if there are multiple hardlings created to a file, although you may delete one file, it doesn't actually even go and do this. Okay? It will only do step 3, which is remove the descriptor from the directory. Okay? Is this clear what I just said? First, people know what a hardlink is? You know what a shortcut is, right? Or an alias? No. So that's actually called a soft link. A hard link is a way to associate two names for the same file. Okay, so the file actually has two names. There are two ways to get to it in the file system. So you use the command ln in Linux to do this, or Unix or Macs for that matter. Okay, so now if you have two names for the file, so for example you might have bin foo and there is a hard link to this. So both of these actually point to the same file. Okay. So if you go and remove this file, okay, so you are not yet removed this file. So it will actually not go and do this step. Okay. What you do is you actually associate a ref count to this file, saying how many file names actually point to this file, and you just decrement that by one. Okay, when that ref count goes to zero, that's the time when you actually delete the file, because you know that there is no other ways to access this file. Okay, so that's one additional detail. We'll talk about hard links in just a few slides again. Okay, opening a file. Okay, this is simple. Okay, you check if the file is already open. Okay, so suppose you are a process, you want to open a file for either reading or writing. Okay. You first check if it's already opened by some other process. If so, there will be a descriptor for this file in this global file table. Okay. So in that case, you'll just copy the system descriptor from the system-wide table to the per process table. Okay. So you also have to check, once you find the file, check the protection bits of the file. Are you allowed to open this file? Okay. If you don't have permissions, then you will have to abort. Once you do this, you open the increment count and then you create an entry in the per process file table. Okay, and then you initialize the current pointer, file pointer, to the start of the file. There's always, whenever you open a file for input or output, there's always the current position of the file. This is where the next operation is going to be performed, the read or write operation. Okay. So initially you point that to the beginning of the file. Okay, you can move it anywhere you want, but when you initialize open the file, you start from the beginning. Okay. Close is just the opposite. You just remove the per entry from the per process file table. You decrement the open count. Okay. And if the open count goes to zero, okay, you also remove the entry from the global file table, because no other process has this file open. Okay. So that's fairly simple. Okay. So let's talk about read and write. Okay. So there are two types of reads that a file system will support, a sequential read and a random read. Okay. What's the difference between the two? You're done, I mean, you must have done some file IO in your program, right? So you should know the difference between reading from a random location and reading sequentially. Do people know what random access is? You do, right? Can read to from an arbitrary location in the file. What is sequential access? You just read sequentially, okay, one byte after another. Okay, so there are two read calls to support these two types of operations. Okay, if you want to do random read, you have to specify not only the size of the read but also the location in the file that you want to read from. Okay, that's called random read. That's what is done shown there. So you have a file ID, you also specify from. Yeah, which is where the offset that you want to read from. Okay, and you say how many bytes you want to read and you specify a buffer. Okay, so that many bytes will be read from that location and stored in the buffer. Okay, the sequential read, you don't have the from field. The only difference between this and this is the from field is gone. Okay, because you are reading sequentially, you know where you have read until now. So you just say read 20 more bytes and you just read 20 bytes from that location and you update the file pointer. So you are reading from the current position in the file where the file pointer is pointing. Okay, that's sequential read. Okay, is that clear? Do you need both? Why do we need sequential read if you can always do random reads? Will be faster. Why?
Well, I guess like I know like I don't know why. I'm assuming that in some cases sequences could be faster than random reads.
Yes, it is true, but. But what I asked was not whether it's faster. I'm saying, do you need both? Yes.
Well, with the random access here, you're going to use up more memory because you're going to load up maybe a huge chunk of a file, and then you can go anywhere you want within the file. But with the sequential, you only need to load up small chunks at a time.
That's not true. So the read operation is actually being issued by processes, right? I'm just asking, if you're writing a program, okay, do you need both? Right? So how you call it is up to the application. Whether you issue large reads and then store everything in a buffer and do something, or you issue small reads, you could do it in both cases. Because size is an argument that tells you how many bytes you want to read. So all I was asking is, if you have that, you don't need this because you can just emulate the current file pointer using the from operation.
From is supposed to be random.
Sorry?
From is supposed to be random.
From is supposed to be random.
Is there any guarantee that you're going to get all of the read?
Is there any guarantee that you will get what? All data?
Yeah, all the data with using from.
Absolutely. I mean, you basically specify, let's say, in fact, any file system implementation actually just does one, implements that, and this is just a small function that calls that. If you actually look at how typical file systems implement these two calls. Sorry? Yeah, you don't need both. It's from an application standpoint, it's convenient to provide both. So you can use either one, but internally you only implement one and emulate the other. Because what this is going to do is it's going to just put the current file pointer as from and call that. When you issue this, you don't specify from, so you can internally substitute that as by this current file pointer and just invoke that, and that's what you have to do. There's a hand somewhere here. Yes.
I was just saying, I mean, I know it's on the Linux, but you know how they use files to represent input ports and network ports.
Yep.
So when you do
Yes, so if you call the other one, it will give you an error. You can't seek into a device, for example. So it will, you can, this is, you can issue that system call, but it will not do anything. Because the interface will just return an error saying this operation doesn't make sense for this type of device. That's what it would do. So there was a question about what it would do. So in the second one, you specify an offset saying read from this position and read this much data. That's the from field and the sizes. You basically say I want to read these many bytes starting at this position. And the second one just has a current file pointer. And it basically says from this file pointer read this much data. Okay, so you can actually just take the second one and then just call the first one saying read whatever ID, file pointer, size, buffer. And this is what you could do to emulate the second one. Yes, question there.
What keeps track of the file pointer? Because if you have the same file.
So I said we'll come back to this. So for each process, you have a per process file descriptor. You have You have the file pointer. So if three processes have it open. There are three entries. Okay, one for within each process file table, and each has a different file pointer. Okay, this is why this is not stored in the global file table. It's stored in the per process file table. Okay, so this is per process state. So it's stored in the piece process control block. Okay, so we still haven't talked about how read is actually implemented. Okay, it's not on this slide. You're just saying that you copy what is there in the file into the buffer, but that's not what read does. Okay, what would read have to do? Okay, let me just draw this file. So suppose let's just take the first one. Okay, so you give a from offset, you give it a size, and you issue the read command. What would the OS have to do to satisfy this?
So they have to find the start address.
Yep.
Start
read the file. Okay. So remember that this file is actually stored on a disk. Okay. And we'll see that the files are not necessarily stored contiguously. So just as we took an address space of a process and chopped it up into pages and just scattered all the pages into memory, similarly files are chopped up into fixed size blocks. So block 1 may be stored here and block 2 may be stored here. So file is not stored contiguously on disk. Okay, so this is how a file would be stored. There would be another data structure, just as you had a page table, you have an index structure that actually points to these blocks. So when you actually issue this read call, what you have to do is first you go and index this metadata. In the context of Unix, it is called an inode or an index node. Okay, this is the metadata for the file. And you say, I need to read from this from offset. Okay, which block of the file is that? Let's suppose it's the third block of the file. Okay, then you index this inode and say, where is the third block on disk? So that will say it is this block number on disk. Okay. So then what you have to do is you actually have to go and issue a command to the device driver for the disk saying go read this block from disk. Okay, so then the device driver will go off and it will start reading the block. At some later point in time, the device is actually going to read the block and hand it back to the device driver. So then the device driver comes back to this system call and says, I got this block. Here is a kernel buffer for the block. So once you have that, then what you do is this. Basically, this is the kernel buffer that you read from the disk. You actually copied into the user-specified buffer, and then the system call returns. Okay. So basically, steps are, you want to read from a certain location. First, find out where that data is on disk. Okay, that's what is being done here. Then issue a command to the device driver to read that data. Okay. Now, incidentally, there's also a file system cache to speed things up. Okay, so you actually look in the cache for saying, has this block been read already? Is it in the cache? If so, you'll return it immediately. You don't have to go back to the disk. But if it's not in the cache, you issue a command saying, go read this location from disk. And then the device driver is going to do it for you. And then when the data comes back, you copy it into the user-specified buffer and you're done. Okay. So this is what you have to do internally to implement the read call. Yeah, sequential access is the same. The write is the same, okay, except that you're doing things in the other way. So what you specified a buffer and you say write it out. Okay. So what do? You basically copy that user buffer into a kernel buffer. Okay. And then you go allocate. So if you're not overwriting existing data, let's say you're writing to the end of a file, okay, you'll go and allocate new disk space. You'll allocate, let's say, new block. If you used up the current block, you may allocate a fifth block. Okay, so you go from the free block list, pull out a block, you add it to this inode, okay, and then you tell the device driver saying, go write this data into that block. So the device driver will go in and then it will actually write the contents out to the disk. Okay, when that's done, then you return back to the application saying the write has finished. Okay, is this clear? Any questions here? Yes.
Are the block sizes proportional to the disk size, or are they usually fixed for the operating system?
Block size is determined when you create the file system. When you format the file system for the first time, the block size is actually specified as an argument. Okay? Typically, most operating systems or file systems will have a default, which would be between 1K and 4K. Okay, so typical block sizes will be 4K. So although you may have a smaller file, you would actually allocate at least 4K for it, if it 4K is the block size. This is not determined by the disk, it's determined by the file system. And the file system tunes it based on what type of workload it expects to see. We'll talk about block sizes and what implications it has on file system performance, okay, in the next class. Okay. So there are some other calls. There is a seek. Seek just updates the file pointer. You can seek to a certain location and that is going to update it for you. Then there is memory map, which you should all know because you are using mmap and munmap in your assignment. Okay. So what does memory map do? It maps a portion of a file into the virtual address space of an application. Okay. And so from that point on, you can just read or write to a memory address and that all automatically triggers reads or writes to a file. Okay, so you don't have to explicitly issue a read or write command if you mmap a file into a process address space. Okay, so let me just show you an example. Okay, because this may not be as trivial as it seems. So this is a disk. Let's say this is a file on disk. Okay, file is foo. Okay. This is RAM, okay, and this is a process. Okay, this is your process P. Okay. When you mmap a file, what the operating system does, it is actually maps this file into the address space. Okay. This is just a mapping, it hasn't fetched the file. Okay. It just mapped these disk blocks to these memory blocks. Okay. From this point on, this file actually appears as a memory buffer. Okay? So you could just go and write to any memory location. Think of it as an array of bytes. Okay? So this is file of I. So you could just go and say file of I is A. Write a character A to some location, the ith location of this file. What this will do, if you just do this, you basically it will go and trigger a disk write. Similarly, if you try to read a particular location, that internally triggers a disk read because it will go and read that block, put it into this memory location and return you whatever you are reading. Okay? So you can manipulate files as if you are reading and writing memory. No explicit read or write calls are necessary once you mmap a file into a process address space. Okay? Is this clear? Now, why are you using mmap in your project? That's the other question. You are not doing any of this. Yes. Right. So, it basically you are at what file are you reading there? Right. Okay. So, what does that? Do you know what that file is? So what you have done in your project, you have taken this file called /dev/0 and you have mmapped it into your process. Yeah, so what does that do?
It's all null characters.
Okay. So slash dev slash zero is a special, it's not a real file. It's a pseudo device that basically just returns zeros or null characters. Okay. So if you read from this file, okay, what this is going to give you is it's going to give a block of null characters. If you read one block, let's say one page from this worth of data from this file, it's going to give you null characters. Okay. So what does that give you really? So when you read, let's say, 4K from this file, what the operating system is going to do is it's going to read a bunch of zeros, allocate a new frame, okay, and write out those zeros into your frame. Okay, so you effectively got one page, and the page is zeroed out. Okay, so you basically got a zeroed out page. So that's what you're doing. That's how you're allocating memory using mmap. Okay, basically you do two things. The reason you use slash dev slash zero is to get a page that's all zeroed out, and this is automatically done because this device just returns zeros to you. Okay, and by reading from it, you have to allocate a new frame, which is how you also allocate memory in the process. Okay, yes, you have a question there.
Yeah, so we're doing that because we don't have access to the software.
Yes, so this is an easy way to allocate memory. If there was, you could explicitly ask for kernel memory, then you could have used that system call. This is an indirect way to do it. Okay, by reading from it, it has to read it into some memory location, so it allocates a new frame for it and it gives it to you. Okay? Alright. Okay, so let's go back to files and file systems here. So there are two types of two types of access patterns from a programmer perspective and two types of access patterns from an OS perspective. Okay. So from a programmer's perspective, if you're doing any file I/O, you either want to do sequential access, which is basically you read or write sequentially to the file, or you do what's called indexed access or keyed access. Okay. So you go to a certain location and you read it, and there may be index associated with it. Okay. This is typically done if you are doing a database search, or you are doing a dictionary search, or you're searching in a hash table. You are actually doing indexed access into the file. Okay. If you are just reading a file, the compiler is compiling a file, it just reads the whole file sequentially into memory. Okay, it translates the source file into object code and sequentially writes the object code out. Okay, so a lot of accesses actually tend to be sequential. If you open a file in your editor, okay, this editor is actually doing sequential access on the file. It's just reading the whole file into memory and displaying it to you in the editor. And when you save the file, it's doing the opposite. It sequentially writes out the whole file back. Okay, to this. So a lot of this accesses that you see in typical applications are sequential, but there will be many applications like databases and dictionary searches that use keyed accesses. Okay, this is from the application's perspective. Now what that translates from an operating system standpoint, sequential accesses translate to sequential reads or writes. Keyed accesses translate to random reads or writes. You are reading and writing to random locations to a file, and in the sequential case, you are accessing sequentially. Okay. Now there was a question earlier about, or rather a point made earlier saying sequential access is faster. Okay. Now why would that be the case? The reason it is faster is that if the file system actually detects that you are accessing a file sequentially, it can do prefetching of the file. Okay. It can read in the file before you explicitly issue the read command for you. Because it has detected that you are accessing the file sequentially, this is a performance optimization. Okay, so let's say, take this file. Okay, so let's assume that this is the current file pointer and you read from the beginning of the file, okay, all the way to this location and you are reading the file sequentially. If the file system detects it, what it does is it issues additional read commands on behalf of the application from this file offset to some point later in the file and starts prefetching this file into the file system cache. Okay. At some later point in time, the application is actually going to issue the next sequential read. Okay. And by this time, whatever read the file system had issued on your behalf may have already completed and the data is already in the cache. So that read will finish very quickly, giving you a performance boost. Okay. So prefetching files during sequential access, prefetching portions of the file during sequential accesses helps you speed up your read calls. Okay. So that's an optimization we'll talk about when we discuss file systems next time. Okay, but this is something to keep in mind. This is why it is faster. Okay. So the last thing we are going to talk about is directories. Okay, so you know what a directory is. It's basically a collection of files that you have on your disk. Okay, now, so there are many types of directories. Early operating systems really didn't have a directory structure. What that meant was there was one giant disk. Well, disks were not that giant in those days. Disk sizes are like 20 megabytes or some small disks. But disks, but you have all your files at the top level directory. This is called a single level directory structure. Okay, everything is in one directory. Okay, no subdirectories, nothing. Okay. So there is a special area that holds the disk. So the early versions of DOS actually did this. Okay. So you have file name and index pair. So what that also means is all file names have to be unique. Okay, if you create a file called foo, you cannot have another file with the same name. Okay, because it all resides in the same directory. Okay, so you can't have two files with the same name in one directory. So this meant that if you are sharing this disk with someone else and they wanted to create a file foo and you already created one, they are out of luck. Okay, you can't do this. Okay. So then they said, let's generalize it. Let's create these two level directories. Okay. Each user gets their own directory. Okay, so you can name your files whatever you want and this doesn't clash with whatever else another user does. Okay. So one root directories and then a bunch of directories in there and files are contained within each directory. Okay. So the obvious generalization is what we have today, which are multi-level directories, which means there's no restrictions on how many subdirectories or what levels you have. Okay, you have directories can contain other directories, you can have arbitrary levels of nesting. Okay, so you get what is called a tree structured namespace. Okay, so you have a root directory, so every file has a name. Okay, and its full name includes the entire path from the root file system. Okay, so you might have created a file called foo, but the actual name may be, let's say, home shinoi foo. Okay, so this is the name of a file. So it actually tells you what the nesting is for this file. So what is the directory is contained in, where is that directory contained all the way up to the root. Okay, so when you open a file, I didn't mention this in the beginning, but if you have an arbitrary level directory structure, when you open a file, first you have to track down where the file is. So here is, let's say you want to do user local bin Netscape or Firefox or what have you. To figure out where the blocks of this file are, you have to do a multi-level lookup. Okay? So the file system starts, so this is a file name that you specify, saying, oh, go open this file and you specify this name. Okay. If you don't specify this name internally, the file system appends the current working directory to the name and you get this name. Okay. So you start from slash user. Okay, let's just try to resolve this name. So you go to slash. Okay. Then you say, is there a directory called user in there? Okay.
Okay. Silent. I'm sorry about
that. Okay. So you start with the root directory and you look whether there is a directory called user. You see, do you have permissions to access it? Okay. Then you look within users. Okay, then you open the users directory and you say, is there another directory called local in there? Okay, and do you have permissions to access local? Okay, let's say the answer is yes. Okay, then you look within local and say, is there a permission or rather a file, not file, in this case still a directory called bin, and do you have permissions to access it? Okay. And then once you have gotten hold of bin, you say, is there a file called Netscape in there, and do you have permissions to access it? If the answer is yes for all of this, then your file open succeeds. It's not like you just look at this file and you have permissions to access it, because you may have closed permissions at the user level, so you shouldn't really be accessing this without checking the whole chain. You have to do this entire multi-level lookup to figure out whether you have permissions to access it and also to get access to the blocks of a file. Where are the blocks stored? This is how a typical file system will resolve a name, okay, when you try to open a file or create a file or rename it. Okay. So let's now talk about a referential naming. Okay, this is where these hard links and soft links come into the picture. So as I mentioned, a hard link is basically also called an alias. Okay, it's a second name for the same file. Okay, so this file now has two names. It's the same file on disk, but there are two ways to get to it. There are two files. The way you do it is you basically use the ln command. So if you just do ln foo and bar, say bar, then basically the file that is currently named foo gets a new name called bar, and that looks like a two independent files, but they are actually the same file internally. Okay. So here is how you, what happens internally. So initially you have file A, and let's say this file number 100. Internally all files are numbered, okay, which we'll come to next time. So then when you do ln AB, then B also starts pointing to the same file. Okay, so there are two names, A and B, that both point to this file number 100. Okay, so there are two names for it. Okay. And what the OS does is it, in file 100, it keeps a ref count saying how many names do I currently have. Okay, in this case, the answer is 2. Typically, it will be 1 if you don't have links created to this. So every time you delete a file, the ref count is deleted. And only when the ref count goes to 0 do you actually release the blocks of the file. Okay, so if you do this and you delete A, you are not going to release blocks of this file because B is still pointing to this file and it's a valid name. Okay, so after you delete B, then the file has no longer any names to get to it. So in this case the ref count goes to 0 and this is when you will actually release the blocks of a file. Okay, is this clear? Okay. Now one problem with creating hard links is that it can create circular loops in your file system. Okay? And that's going to be a problem for many applications. So let me give you an example of what this means. Okay, let's take the Unix structure. So you have slash, then your directory is in slash. So you may have user, you may have bin, you may have local and whatnot. And then there may be other, and then let's say this home, then say there is home directories in here. So if you actually do an ln on a directory, okay, so if let's say I do ln Shenoy foo, what's going to happen is these two will sort of will point in this way. Okay. Now this creates a loop, okay, because you have your loop in this file system, and that can create lots of problems for applications like backups for applications that like tar and all of these other things that recursively traverse through the file system. If there's a loop, these applications will never terminate. They'll just keep cycling through the loop. Okay, so because of this problem, okay, many file systems impose a severe restriction which say that you cannot create hard links to directory. You want the directory structure to be a directed acyclic graph or a DAG. Okay? So to make sure that it's a DAG, you have to eliminate this restriction to allow hard links to directory. Because if I create a, actually this is not the loop. The loop is if I do this. Okay, so then I have a loop here. Okay, so you want to prevent cases like this, because now if I'm trying to say backup home, that backup application will never terminate. So if I try to backup home, this backup application will never terminate because it will just descend into this directory. It will try to backup all the files here. It will find out a subdirectory called home, which is actually an ancestor. It will go back here and it will keep looping. Okay, so then you have a problem. So to prevent problems like this, you will actually not allow you to create hard links. But you can create soft links, which we will see in the next slide. Okay, so hard links you can only create between files but not directories. That's the thing to keep in mind. Yes, question.
Now, if you have you create a hard link between two files and you were to delete
file A, will file B still point to the memory location? So it wouldn't effectively be, the file will still be there under file B.
Yes, we can actually see it. So let's do it. So I say create a file called, can't do foo, foo is a directory. Let's say I create a file called bar, say this is a test. Okay, so I have returned bar, so bar has been created. Okay. So now I created a hard link. Okay, so there are two files. There's a file called bar, there's a file called bar2. Okay, if you look inside both of the files, you will actually see the same thing.
Is that
kind of
like a copy then?
Yeah, it is basically, this is what I mentioned here. These are two names that point to the same file internal. It's not a copy.
Oh, because
it is basically two things pointing to the same file. Okay.
So if you change the data
in one, you so you can do that. Yeah. So I wrote another, this is a test. You will see that bar 2, it's the same file. In fact, you can check this without doing all this by seeing what's the file number. So if you do ls minus I, you know the number of the file. So here is bar and bar 2, they have the same number. This is the inode number. Okay, so exactly the same number. Yes, so there's a ref count in the inode which you cannot see, but I think there's an option, but I don't remember what it is. So anyway, so let's now go and delete one. Yeah, so I deleted the original one. Yeah, so bar is gone. Okay, but bar 2 is still here. So you can see that the contents are not gone. You can see that it's still there. Yeah, see the ref card, it's the same file number that was there. Yeah, so now if I delete bar, then the data goes out. Okay, that's what I was mentioning. So that's hard links. Soft links are what you probably have encountered if you have created an alias in Macs or shortcuts in Windows. That's what a soft link is. It's basically an alias that you have created for the name. Okay. It's not this differs from hard links in the following fashion. Okay. Soft link is a symbolic pointer. Okay. You don't have two files pointing to the same thing. Just keep a pointer. Okay. So here you have file A, that was file 100. Okay. You create a soft link, which should be ln minus s. If you do ln, you create a hard link. So it should be ln minus s. Then what you have is you still have this file. But inside B, you say, if I open B, go to A. You actually store this here. In the previous case, what happened was you had A and B both pointing to the same file internally. Okay. Here, A is still the original file. You just say, you key when you in B, you just say, if I try to access B, go look up A. Okay? This is what is called a symbolic link. Okay? So now I can actually remove B, and then this information goes away, A still remains intact. Or alternatively, if I remove A, B is still there, okay? But B is going to point to a dangling, it's a dangling pointer. It's saying go open A, but A does not exist. Okay? So let me show you some examples again. Yes, there was a question there.
So if you do a hard link for a directory in most modern operating systems, is it going to automatically assume symbolic, or is it going to return an error?
If you do it, I think it returns an error. We'll try. Just one second. Let's do a symbolic link. Okay, so we have our bar 2. So I'm going to do a symbolic link saying bar 2. I'm going to create bar 3. Okay. So we have bar 3 here. Okay, but if you actually look at, so you can see what is showing you here. This is bar 2. It says bar 2. Bar 3 is basically a pointer to bar 3. It's not the same file. It's a different file. It just internally says, if I try to access this file, go look up that file instead. It's basically like a one level of indirection. Okay. So it looks similar. So if I actually do cat on bar 3, it will actually read the same file. So it looks like both of them are pointing to the same file, but it is through a level of indirection. You don't directly point. You just keep a forwarding address saying, if I want to go here, go look, go there instead. Okay? Is this clear? So So now we could actually go and remove bar 2. Okay, so the original file is gone. Okay, the symbolic link is still there. Okay, this is a dangling pointer. This is where you have an alias, but the original thing is moved or is gone somewhere. Now what would happen is you should get an error. Okay, so if I try to access it, it shows that we have an error. Okay. So that's a symbolic link. The same thing as in what you get when you create an alias. So if you have, I don't know how to create one, but I think there's a way to create an alias. But anyway, so that's what you will do internally. Okay, so what was the question about hard links? Let's try one. Okay, so we have foo. So we'll show foo bar 4. We got an error saying it's a directory, so it's preventing you from creating a hard link to a directory. Yeah, that's what, this is exactly what we mentioned. So he said with no hard links to directory, so it'll check what are you creating it to and prevent you from doing it. Yeah, but soft links you can create. So if I had just done ln minus s here, it would have allowed me to do this. Yeah, so then you will have, you created a soft link to a directory instead of a file. Yeah, so here is bar 4, it's pointing to this directory.
You consider the 100 the name of the file?
Yeah, internally files don't have names. They actually have are numbered. Okay, that the number of a file is the inode that is associated with it. So if you do ls minus I, you will get the number of a file. Or a directory for that. Everything is numbered. So you will see that they all have numbers. Okay, so that's the actual, that's how the file system deals with files internally.
So how does soft links stop loops?
How do soft links stop loops? Because when you open a file, okay, in a hard link I don't even know there is a link. Okay, in a soft link I can check, is this a real file or a soft link? So if it says it's a soft link, I don't follow it. But in hard link, there is no way for me to know that because it just looks like a normal file. So if you do backups, in this case, what would happen is it would open that file and say, is this a real directory or is it a soft link to a directory? If it's a soft link, say, I don't follow that because I'm not going to touch soft links. That's what it will do. Yes.
Just one more quick question. Since all modern file systems store a lot of metadata about files, why can't we just have an arbitrary number of files in the same file and then you just open the most recently saved copy so you can just, you know, easily find backups and stuff?
You would have to do that, but if you had a unique name, the file system, if I had two files with the same name, the file system doesn't know your intent. If you only allow me to open the most recent file, then how do I get to one version before that?
Like, right? Specifically say, like, I want an older version or something like that.
Right. So that is, that you can always emulate by just giving, let's say, appending the version number to the file name. Right? Which is what many operating systems do. It will basically say foo v1, v2, v3, v4. So it will have these internal versions. So the name is not exactly the same in that case. You have the version appended to it. So you can do that. Alright, so let's stop here. We run out of time. We'll continue this discussion next time. Okay, so.